Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, Michigan House Appropriations Committee Chair Angela Whitwer says the state needs more spending on direct economic incentives, not less. She breaks down why, along with the significant spending priorities for House Democrats in their past 2024 budget. Should Michigan return to a fusion voting? Former Republican Congressman Dave Trott says the Common Sense Party could temper political extremism by endorsing moderate candidates. And a former Republican gubernatorial candidate has already announced his candidacy in Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. Financial consultant Michael Markey talks about what he learned in 2022 and what he thinks about the Bud Light controversy. Now here's MERS editor Kyle Malin and publisher John Roering.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. Joining us here in MERS World Headquarters is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Angela Whitwer. Thanks for joining us over here, making the trip.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
We've got a budget that's passed. Things massive.
It's similar to last year's. It's close to last year's.
It's $81 billion.
Yeah. The House is $81 billion. The governor's is $79. We'll end up right around there, probably.
It's going to get cut eventually, isn't it?
I would think, yeah. We'd have to cut some of it. It'll get cut through the negotiation process, I'm sure, cut down.
Is it fair to call this kind of a best case scenario, kind of wish list kind of thing?
I think it's very accurate what the needs are. I think we could have spent more, actually, if you listen to the people in school aid, but we still are putting away money. We're trying to be fiscally responsible. We just have more one-time money than we've had. So some of the things that you see in the budget are actually funded only one time, and the people that, or the places that it is one time, they're aware of that. They'd have to come back and see if we have the ability to fund those in future years.
None of the budgets in either chamber passed with any Republican support. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. So this year, generally in the past few terms that I've been here, we do zeroed out budgets, and then they cross chambers and they don't concur and they go to conference. This year we did it differently. We actually passed full budgets and we got all our members. They all voted for everything in it. And I was kind of surprised that the marginal members on the other side of the aisle didn't vote for police, didn't vote for fire, didn't vote for a lot of things that were really important in this budget. But it did. It went straight party line.
Is that just the state of play we're in today or what?
Yes, I get asked about it almost every week in my coffee hours. People ask, how do we fix this? And I do think it's the state of play. Every time we go on the floor for any vote, we never know if we'll get any votes from the other side. It's more politics. I talk about this a lot versus what's good for people. And that's unfortunate. And I hope now that the term limits are going to be a little bit longer, that we get back to the people versus politics constantly.
It's about leverage, isn't it? I mean, they're just trying to create a negotiation point.
They've had quite a few wins, but at some point, everything that you get asked for in a negotiation is usually for money, and that we can't keep paying out money for votes. We just have to be able to hope for some sort of collaboration. And relationships with me and the other side are strong, with the speaker and the other side. But if there's a missing vote at all, the other side would prefer to kill the bills versus even vote on good bills, even vote on bills that their own members have.
This budget, though, is different than past budgets. The subcommittee chairs were kind of autonomous in this process up to now. Is that correct?
That is correct. They were given targets from my office. So I was told from House Fiscal that in the past decades, the subcommittee chairs would not be the people that would actually make their own budgets. The chair would form most of it and then get, you know, some input from the subcommittee chair. These budgets were fully built by the subcommittee chairs and their committees. So you'll see, you know, school aid is very much solidly built by Representative Weiss and on. And then we set the targets. We gave them some must-haves inside their budgets and must-stay-away-froms in their budget. And then They built the rest of it around those.
Do you anticipate chairs will have a role in the final decision making that occurs post consensus revenue estimating conference?
Yes, I think that we will go to, well, I think we'll go to conference in each one of the budgets, and the chairs will have that point to be able to negotiate with the Senate chair and build out the budget that they would like to see.
Okay.
Because that hasn't been the case, I think, in past budgets where it's been maybe like four or five people in the room kind of hammer out the whole thing.
We'll still have the end where it'll be the leaders of both chambers and the governor's office will be in a room, and they'll nuance out some of it, but most of it will be done with the chairs.
So they'll just be given a target.
Mm-hmm. They'll get a new target after the 19th with the consensus.
Because that's a significant difference. We've talked about it before, how if you were elected in the last few years and you were subcommittee chair, it didn't mean as much as it used to when I started. I mean, they actually hammered it out.
Right. It's not my style. I don't believe it's Senator Anthony's style either. If you are given a responsibility, I think you should do your responsibility. And each one of them are very eager. They did a great job. We haven't had a budget in a long time. Our party has not had a budget. And so the chairs actually went line by line and looked at vendors that were in the budget, interviewed all of them, got reports from all of them, cut some things, and added a couple things. Most of it is more like funding, more funding for per pupil in school aid, but they did cut some of the vendor stuff out if they didn't feel like it was delivering what they thought it should deliver.
Barring any shocking news coming out of Friday's Consensus Revenue Student Conference, when do you anticipate this whole process to be concluded?
I expect that people are hopeful that it's the first part of June. I think it'll be mid-June when realistically it'll probably be mid-June.
What's the House Democrats' stamp on the budget? Like, what is in this budget that, as House Democrats, as a caucus, you all want to see signed?
So we really like the school aid budget. We have increased per pupil allotment. We've taken care of mental health care. We wish there was more we could do, but we also like the free lunches. As a former school board member, every kid getting lunch is really important. That's a real shame stamp on a kid when they have to not have a regular lunch with their friends. So I like taking that away from one of the pressures with kids in school. Also in healthcare, I think that the mental health part of it, the funding of that is very important, and food for families. So we're excited at the environmental part of it. We're very excited about the budget. There was no borderline disappointments. We're adding more money into affordable housing. It will be upwards of $150 million, hopefully, at the end of this. And so we're very excited about that also.
What's the most significant difference between the House and Senate passed bills?
I think there's a lot of definition across the board in the House budgets. I think DHHS budget is a little more defined in the House budget. Universally across the whole state, it hits a lot of people in Michigan. And I think you just will see a lot more lines of definition in the House budgets. They're both very solid. The governor's budget is very solid. We just had to balance it out a little bit and make sure that it hit all the people in the state.
Do you think we're done with the SOAR fund money for a while? Like putting more money into the SOAR fund? You think we're going to take a break from that?
I hope not.
Really?
I know. I think it's really important. Until there is a national call to stop doing this, why would we stop competing? So we are in probably the next 18 months are the most important time right now with the CHIPS Act. And it'll probably be done within the next 18 months, and Michigan certainly will want to be a part of that. And we need tools in our toolbox, and there's more that we can do other than SOAR. We just need to get on that, because this is a very important time in our country, very important time for our state, and I think SOAR is one of those tools that we need to have.
So when you see all this commotion about Goshen, what kind of runs through your head?
I wish that maybe they would have taken a look at it harder last year when they passed it through, when the Republicans passed it through the appropriations process. But this year, there's a lot of false news about Goshen.
I like how you said false and not fake news.
Yes, I did. I do too. But there's a lot of fake things that are being said about Goshen. And I talk about that every single week in my coffee hour. There are people that come from around the state and talk about Goshen and projects from China and really want to make everything about that.
The Republicans have consistently accused the new Democratic majority of abusing power by taking the legislature out of the admin board transfer process and weaponizing the bureaucracy against businesses. How do you respond to that as chair of appropriations?
I've really ignored a lot of things that are said. I know we felt the same way, and I think they're just having a hard time adjusting to minority status right now. And if we could get back to that, you'll see a lot of these political things that are going on worked out just fine. Democrats are actually very nice and they want to care about the other side. And it's just, they're just having a really hard time adjusting to it right now.
Well, you see their point though, is that the legislature doesn't have any safeguards over the administration. They could just move money all over the place. And the legislature, whether it's a Democrat or Republican controlled legislature, wouldn't have the stopgaps to prevent it.
I can appreciate some of the things that are said, but I think again, that we've worked well all along with them, and I would like to see them work well with us.
But you don't want to see the administration just shift money around without your okay, right? I mean, that's what happened in 2019 when things kind of ground to a halt.
I think the administration works well with us right now, so I don't think that that will happen. I think that this is a lot of rhetoric that is being said, and I do not think that will happen.
Let's talk about aggregates a second. Why did you put your name on this legislation that would standardize aggregates statewide, the mining of this gravel that's used for road building, as opposed to leaving it at the local level?
So I did that because I believe in the policy, but moreover, I'm the appropriations chair and I have to be responsible for the money that the state has and the way that we spend it. And we are having a difficult time bringing in aggregate. And when we bring it in from the state outside of the state, it is heavy in heavy trucks. It hurts our roads. And the farther we go away to pick up our aggregate, the more damage it does to our roads and the more expensive it is for the state. And so it was important enough for me to put my name on it. Now, I also think it's very important, and I always want to write the definition up on my wall of negotiate. And I do think it's really important. We did put the bills in, but the bills will be negotiated. You will see changes. Definitely will see changes. And we are trying to work with both the environmentals and the local government. And we are going forward with good faith negotiations. And we're hoping that everyone comes to the table and does the same thing. It's one of the few things left that is actually mined outside of the state watching over it.
But local governments are concerned that they're not going to have a say in anything, that the state can just say, hey, well, you're going to have an aggregate mine here and that's going to hurt property values, it's going to create a lot of noise, trucks running down their roads, up and down the roads. Shouldn't they have some kind of say in this process?
That's why we've asked them to come to the table to talk about how we can amend the bills and make sure that they do have a say in things. It is not my intent to ever take away anything from the locals. It is my intent to make it easier, smoother, and my intent to be able to save the state money.
The last question I want to ask you is, you touched on the size of the budget at the beginning of the podcast. Is the spending level the state's had since COVID sustainable long-term, or do you expect things to start to slide back down?
I expect that we'll have to do some cuts. Since COVID, we have had a huge injection of federal money, and I expect that we'll have to adjust budget levels so that it reflects the fact that we won't get that kind of money into the state.
Let's change gears altogether here, focusing on Congress, okay? You're not going to run for Congress, are you?
No.
It just doesn't appeal to you.
I said in an article last week, and I do feel this way. First of all, I've told you several times I I have 7 minutes. It takes me 7 minutes to get to the Capitol and Park, and I get to go home every night. And if I forget something, I can run home. I already feel bad for the people in Detroit that have to drive here from Detroit on those highways that are all a mess right now. And I like my husband, and I like to go home at night. So I don't even like to have dinner out with people. I like to go home and eat dinner with my husband. So I can't imagine leaving on Monday and coming home Friday and not seeing him for all week long and not being able to see my friends. So it really isn't a big interest. And then on top of that, I'm the appropriations chair for, I would say, arguably the best speaker we've ever had. And I am fortunate that I get to work alongside Joe Tate. And I can't see a day where I would say it sounds fun to get into that mess of DC. It just doesn't sound like something. I'm more effective here for the state and for my district.
Who do you think would be a good Democratic candidate for that seat?
I've talked to a few people that I think would be good. I've read some names and I...
What about Curtis Hertel?
I think Curtis is an excellent politician, and I think he is an excellent person for the people. As senator, he called his constituents. He was always available. He has a lot of the same qualities as I have and as Alyssa has, and I think that it would be a real benefit to our district to have someone that cares that much about our state and about our districts.
How about Barb Byram?
I don't know Barb as well, but she too seems very active. I want a person, because it will be my congressperson, mm-hmm. I want a person that answers their call, works for our district, brings things back from D.C. that are important to our state.
We've only got a couple minutes left. What's something that people bring up to you that maybe we haven't talked about here that doesn't get reported a heck of a lot, but you get a lot of attention, or this is always brought to your attention? What are people talking about that we're not paying attention to?
Lately, people have been talking to me at my coffee hours, and it's kind of shocking to me about the voting where it's all one vote. I can't think of what it's called.
National Popular Vote.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I've had heated debates amongst constituents about National Popular Vote at my coffees every week.
Do you have a position on it?
I don't have a position. They haven't really talked to me much about it.
They just want to argue amongst themselves.
Yeah, if you come to one of my coffee hours, Kyle, you'd be shocked. They argue about a lot of things, and I step back and let them.
Is it pretty even, or is it one side
more than the other? It's really even. Almost every one of there was a call out about 5 weeks ago for the Republican Party to come to my coffee hours, and they've been coming, and they're very... they're very shocked, I think, that I have them every week and I rotate around, and they've been very good constituents, and but they get in these debates from one side or the other and talk about voting. Last week it was about safety of voting and how we're going to fund the proposals, and they get in arguments about the 9-day early voting. That was last week also. So it's been a lot of stuff around voting.
Have you heard much from the governor or your counterparts in the Senate? Do you think we're going to take that up and vote on it?
I have heard nothing in our caucus, and I've heard nothing from any of the other places. But obviously other people in my district have heard, because it's been brought up a lot.
How many people are showing up to these coffee hours?
So the first time they made the call out, I had 100 people. I had to move it from a diner that I love to a church auditorium. And then I had to move it from a small room in the Delta Waverly Library over to the big room, because we had about 70 people at that. We went back to the church, had about 70 people at that one. And then last week we had maybe 40 at Charlotte. Yeah, I think they realize that I'm okay. It's okay.
Wow, that's a lot of coffee you're serving.
I haven't been taking coffee because it's a lot of people, and they don't really want it. They just want to talk about the issues. And then we spend about an hour and a half together every Friday.
Wow. That sounds like the go-to place now on Fridays.
I should go
on when you're a constituent.
You should show up. Yeah.
That's great. Angela Whitwer, House Appropriations Committee Chair. Thanks for dropping into Merce World Headquarters.
Thanks for inviting me.
Join Joining us now on the podcast is former Congressman Dave Trott. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Great to be with you, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell our listeners what you've been up to the last, few years since you've been out of Congress?
Well, I returned to some of our business interests and worked for a good while. We had a fairly significant multi-state title insurance company that we sold a couple of years ago to a private equity group. So I was involved in that and have been, you know, kind of re-engaged in the businesses and otherwise just trying to figure out a way to beat my wife in golf, which isn't going so well.
And she's still a couple strokes lower than you on the score, eh?
Yeah, I think there's just a confidence that she knows that, I can't quite catch her. So that ship has sailed.
Tell our listeners what the Common Sense Party is.
Well, the Common Sense Party is a new initiative in Michigan and also in New Jersey. In New Jersey, it's called the Moderate Party. And the effort is to try and create a third party by getting 45,000 signatures to create the third party. Once that's done, then the plan is to sue the state of Michigan in the Court of Claims, and if necessary, go up to the state Supreme Court to have fusion voting reinstated. And fusion voting is something that our state used until the late 1800s, and many states around the country use. And the idea behind it is, you know, third parties get, you know, 1-2% of the vote. Oftentimes people that vote for the Green Party or the Libertarian Party feel like it's a wasted vote, but it's a protest vote, but it really doesn't accomplish anything. And there are some exceptions, you know, certainly Ross Perot's independent candidacy in 1992 cost George Bush the presidency, and John Anderson in 1980 was a factor. But for the most part, third parties are irrelevant. This would be a different kind of third party, because if you reinstated fusion voting, then the nominee for the Common Sense Party, the votes that he or she got for that party would be added into whatever votes they got as a Democrat or Republican. They'd be fused together. And the idea is not to run our own candidates as in the Common Sense Party, but to nominate, not in every race, but in some races, the Republican or Democratic nominee would be also the fusion or the Common Sense Party's nominee. So those votes would be combined. And that, I think, will have an impact on elections in Michigan.
So how is that different than ranked choice voting, is it?
Yeah, ranked choice voting, which they use in Maine, I think, and it weeds out candidates, I think, whereas here, I think, you know, they take the Senate race in Michigan. If Slotkin is the nominee for the Democrats, which I suspect she will be, she wins the primary. And let's say DiPerno wins the Republican primary. Well, the Common Sense Party would interview both candidates and pick one of them as their nominee for the Common Sense Party based on whoever is the most moderate and offers the most common sense bipartisan solutions. So in that hypothetical, I suspect it would be Slotkin. And so the independents, which are 40% of the voting populace potentially in Michigan, would go into the voting booth. And if they don't feel like they're a Republican or a Democrat, but they like what the Common Sense Party is all about and moderate solutions, then they would pick Slotkin and those votes would be combined. So I think it's a more effective solution than ranked choice voting.
Dave, you said reinstate or go to the Court of Claims. Is there something in state law that already allows for this, but it's dormant? We haven't used it?
No, the Constitution bans it. And again, a lot of states banned fusion voting because they were finding that it was hurting them at the polls. And you can easily see why the state Republican Party, if this effort really gets some momentum, I think the state Republican Party's got to be a little concerned about it. Because I think it would hurt them more than the Democrats in the near term. And so way back when, in many states, including Michigan, the major parties decided it wasn't helping their cause. And there's a constitutional prohibition against fusion voting, and that would need to be challenged in the state court.
Is it fair to say, based on your work on this, you don't think the Republican Party is coming back to a common sense stance?
Well, I don't think it's coming back anytime soon. I did an interview last week where the interviewer was obviously a very conservative Republican, and he was bothered that I was working on something that would forever cost the Republicans elections in Michigan. And I said, well, that's not necessarily the case. You could easily see a scenario where if this effort is successful and you have a couple of election cycles where the Republicans are compromised and lose elections because of the Common Sense Party and the 5 or 10% that gets lumped in with a Democrat, let's say, you could easily see that as being part of the solution to bringing back the Republican Party, because they would get together and go, gosh, I think our formula is a losing proposition. We better come up with a better plan. And maybe they nominate more moderate people. And then you could see the Common Sense Party nominating some of those folks, because the Democratic Party perhaps was too pro-union or too anti-business. So this is not an anti-Republican effort. I think in the near term, it will hurt the Republicans more. But clearly, the Republican Party in Michigan needs to get beyond the MAGA Republicans and the Karamo administration for the state party. Once that happens, then, you know, right now they're dead, but they'll come back.
Did you call Ron DeSantis an asshole?
Well, I was misquoted. I did an interview, and I'm not a big fan of Ron DeSantis. I think he's a bully. I don't particularly like everything he's done down in Florida. I think he's a very arrogant guy. I certainly did tell the story accurately about the 2 years I spent sitting next to him in the Foreign Affairs Committee, and he never said a single word to me. And I think there was some article pro DeSantis where I initially read it, and I was irritated by it. And then I kind of laughed at myself. And the gist of the article was, isn't it terrible that a 50-year-old man is slighted by another 50-year-old man and they're not friends? How terrible is that? And kind of making fun of my story. And the issue with DeSantis is not that he never said hello or introduced himself or never said a single word to me for 2 years. That's kind of irrelevant. It's indicative of a personality and arrogance, an approach to politics that I don't think is good for our country. I think it exacerbates the culture war that already is a problem in our country. But as far as what I said, the reporter said to me, you know, I was criticizing DeSantis, and the reporter said, well, basically, Dave, you know, you think he's an asshole. And I paused, and I almost said, and I should have in hindsight, it's on me. I almost said, you know, I wouldn't use that word, but I paused and I said, yeah. So I guess it's appropriately attributed to me, but I never sui sponte brought up the word asshole. I wish the profanity hadn't been included in the article. And I just hope DeSantis doesn't, you know, decide to audit me or something, you know. So
you've been involved in politics a long time. How would you rate the strength of the party going into an open Senate seat?
The state Republican Party?
State Republican Party.
Oh, I think they're in a horrible condition. It's not really that critical that a Senate candidate have a healthy, strong state party. It helps, but you can build your own organization and grassroots effort if the state party can't come to your aid. But I think the state party has a complete and total inability to raise money. I don't think the administration there has the ability to organize. And so whoever the nominee is for the Republicans certainly can't rely on the state party on any level. And if that person happens to be a more moderate candidate like Peter Meyer, then clearly the state party probably won't lift a finger for him because they think he's an anti-Trumper, which he is. And so he certainly can't count on their support. So no, I think they're in a complete shambles. I laughed when Karamo said, you know, there's a lot of problems and chaos at the state party, so we're going to decentralize. In my experience in business, when things are chaotic, that's probably not the time to decentralize.
Mm-hmm. When do you think the Republican Party went adrift? Was it when they nominated Trump in 16, or were there other signs prior to that?
Well, I think that, you know, the process in Michigan is, it kind of lends itself to playing to the fringes, right? So if you look at how we end up with our attorney general candidate, you know, nominee, our secretary of state nominee, even the lieutenant governor choice, that whole process is done in a convention hall in Lansing by grassroots activists. And those folks tend to be, in both parties, tend to be more on the extreme. You know, the soccer mom in Macomb County who's trying to get two kids to, through their daily activities isn't spending, you know, 48 hours awake in Lansing working on grassroots politics. It's just doesn't, that's something they have time for. So I think the process lends itself to the grassroots folks having perhaps an undue influence on the process. Now, again, the flip side is, you know, and Will Hurd, the former congressman from Texas, was interviewed over the weekend, and he said something, I'm not sure of the statistic, but I think he said 23% of Americans vote in the primaries. So when you say that our politics are too extreme, it's not Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump's fault. They've obviously put together a message that appeals to people. It's the citizens' fault. I mean, if people aren't going to go vote in the primaries, then we're going to end up with the extremes in both parties. So it's on us. It's not the fault of the politicians. Those are the folks that are getting elected. And if people aren't participating in the primary process to pick more moderate candidates, then it's our fault.
You mentioned both Trump and DeSantis so far this morning. Who do you think is going to be the nominee? Is it inevitable that it's going to be Trump? Or,
you know, everyone thinks it's Trump. I think we have a long ways to go. And I think it's going to be DeSantis. I think he's got a war chest of over $100 million. I think once he starts to work on his interpersonal skills a little bit, which we saw a little bit this weekend in Iowa, I think the donor base will start to have more confidence that he can pivot and does have the ability to learn from perhaps some of his shortcomings and overcome them. I think he'll raise more money. And I think Trump's going to have continuing legal problems that ultimately will cause some portion of the primary voters to say, gosh, we love Trump, but we think he's just too damaged. So I think it's going to be DeSantis. And I think, but for his extreme politics in Florida, you know, 6 months ago, I was predicting he was going to be our next president. Now, I think because of the 6-week abortion ban and him taking on Disney and some of the other things, I think the Biden's people, they have to be really flummoxed about what 30-second attack had to run, because there's just so much material that's going to be off-putting to independent voters in this country about DeSantis's record. I think he obviously pivoted hard to the right so that he could position himself to be the most conservative candidate so he could win the primary. But he's really created a problem for himself in the general election, I think.
So looking at the presidential election, then, how do you see the Common Sense Party coming together and, I guess, picking who their favorite is? I mean, what would be the criteria for something like that?
Yeah, we haven't really discussed, you know, we're just getting started trying to get the petitions done and obviously plot out our legal strategy. There is a bad Supreme Court case involving fusion voting in Minnesota that will be an issue ultimately if it gets to the Supreme Court potentially, but that's down the road, the U.S. Supreme Court. But we haven't really discussed, you know, what, or considered, to my knowledge, what our role would be in a presidential campaign in 2024. So I guess if there is an endorsement, then I think if it's an extreme Republican versus Biden, I think we'd have a difficult choice, because I don't think President Biden is really up to serving 4 more years. So I'm not sure we're putting our best foot forward in either party at the moment.
So would you see then the Common Sense Party putting forth their own candidates?
No, that's not the plan. Yeah, that's potentially a wasted vote. You could envision a day, if there really are 30 or 40% of the country who are independent voters, don't really sign on for either major party, you could see a scenario where a moderate party with some success could evolve into a true third party that was a factor in elections. But that's probably 10 years out, at least, after some significant success. I kind of had hoped that Bloomberg would use his $1 billion in the 2020 campaign to set up an independent candidacy. And I've been talking for some time now about we need the Bull Moose Party back from 1912. That's really what we need, the Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party. If you look at the Bull Moose platform, it's very relevant for today. Roosevelt supported a safety net for those who needed it. He wanted to curtail abusive practices by large corporations. He was very concerned about the environment. Wanted a strong foreign policy. Not too far off on where we should be, in my opinion.
So it really sounds like then this Common Sense Party is trying to bring the country back to the middle by encouraging political candidates to move to the middle.
Yeah, I mean, there's three issues in the past week that I think the Common Sense Party could have an impact on. So Title 42 and what's happening on our border and immigration, there's all kinds of common ground, at least there should be, on where some Republicans and some Democrats should be able to agree on our immigration solution and problems. I mean, I know that it's a very toxic, controversial issue, because the conservative Republicans want to kick all the immigrants out and not let anyone in. And the far left want a lot more people in than I think we should allow in. But there's a common ground for moderates to find a solution there. The debt ceiling is another example of all kinds of common ground. And I read this morning that Biden is optimistic, and they're talking and they're maybe making some progress on work programs as it relates to the temporary assistance and SNAP program. So maybe there's common ground. I hope we avoid the fiscal cliff. You know, I spent the last few months working with the governor on her gun safety bills, and did a lot of interviews, called a lot of Republican legislators about those 11 bills. I was disappointed that the only Republicans, I think, that supported any of the bills were a few that supported the safe storage bills. But those bills passed. Gun safety is another example of an issue where there's all kinds of common sense steps we can take that may or may not make a difference. They won't hurt. They won't increase the number of mass shootings. They may reduce the number. And gun safety is perhaps a perfect issue that I think the Common Sense Party could require people to really approach it from a common sense perspective with solutions that can make a difference. You know, the other problem with the extremes is every time a new administration takes over, they immediately start to undo everything that the prior administration from a different party accomplished. And that's not a good thing for our country. As a business person, that's not a good thing as a business person. You know, give me a set of rules and I'll try and figure out a way to make money and run a business based on those rules. But don't change the rules every 4 years on me, because that's just too dramatic for many businesses to handle. So there are a lot of good reasons to have come up with bipartisan common sense solutions that I think most people really want to see happen. And since we started talking about this less than a week ago, I probably received 24 emails and calls from people that say, spot on, how can I help? So I think there's a lot of support, and it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out.
I know that Jeff Timmer is involved in this campaign. We've heard the name Joe Schwartz. Is there any other names out there that we would know as far as people who are interested in pursuing this Common Sense Party?
Yeah, I mean, LeBrant, the former general counsel from the State Chamber of Commerce, is involved on legal issues. And I think this week we'll be releasing the executive board names. So we've got a good group of people that I think can move this forward. And, you know, again, we have two significant hurdles. So it's not by any means a given that we're going to be successful. But it's certainly something that I think will be a game changer for politics in Michigan if it is successful, because it will force political consultants to sit with their candidate and potentially convince them to moderate their views to get the endorsement from the Common Sense Party and capture 5 or 10% of the voters. And again, you know, if you look at someone who walks in the voting booth and they're voting for the Libertarian candidate, they know that their vote's wasted and it's not going to make a difference. If there truly are, 30 or 40% of the voters who are independents who really understand what the Common Sense Party is about, which will be incumbent on us to accomplish that, you could see, 10% of those folks voting for the Common Sense nominee. And that will make a difference in the state of Michigan, because, Peter's only won by 1 or 2 points over James. And that, no question in my mind, the Common Sense Party would have made a difference there. So it'll be interesting to see it play out. And I'm honored to be a part of it, and hope people support it.
Is there a time by which you'd have to file suit to affect the next election?
Yeah, I think we've got 6 months to get the signatures. I think the suit's got to be filed this year. So I think Timmer's more dialed into that than I am, but I think the lawsuit's got to happen this year. So,
former Congressman David Trotz, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, John. Nice to be with you.
Join us now on the podcast is Michael Markey. You might remember him from the gubernatorial campaign. He is back. He's now running for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District next year, which is the Grand Rapids, West Michigan area. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Good to see you again, Michael.
Hey, nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
Why are we doing this again? Or why are we doing this so soon? I mean, we're quite a ways away from an election, but you've already put your toe in the water here.
I don't think we're actually that far away. I mean, we've got a Democratic incumbent who's out there fundraising, and we need to flip this seat, and it's a seat that can be flipped, which means we need to get a viable candidate in early so they can start the fundraising and not start really at a deficit. So we're that viable candidate. And really, I think a message that resonates more with West Michigan.
What did you learn
from this gubernatorial experience from last year that you're going to carry over into this campaign outside of the fact of making sure that the signatures are accurate this time?
Sure. Well, I'll stay with I'm not convinced they weren't, but
okay.
You know, there's a first, I don't know that we're giving me the whole hour of the show. What did we learn? I mean, first, there's a lot of people behind the scenes that you need. And like many things with my business career, and even in sports, oftentimes when we discuss like accomplishments, it sounds like I, but it's really a we. And so one of the things that was very important that we never really got to showcase in the gubernatorial was the team that we put together. And I was very blessed because as you and I were talking earlier, that team stayed on after everything went south. And we continued to work, continued to discuss issues, and then watched for other opportunities. And when Hillary Skolton won the congressional seat, she said she was somebody that was going to represent both Republicans and Democrats. And of course, my team, with the experience that they have, they're like, well, Mike, she won't. Just trust us. She's going to land in D.C. and be totally different. I said, well, you know, I want to see. And it didn't take long for her to prove me right, though, because her very first thing on the congressional floor. Now, some people will take this as an abortion issue. It's not an abortion issue because it was, does a baby who survives a failed abortion deserve medical care? And she cited the Bible for it. And I mean, my joke to that is always, I think she should not read the new King James Version because she didn't get the interpretation right. So to me that, you know, you can have, I don't, you know, abortion's part of our culture and the voters of Michigan put it in, but that's not an abortion issue. Here's a baby who survived against all odds. So that was kind of the final straw for me. And that's when my wife and I decided for sure that we needed to get into this.
You said your team stayed on. You paid them obviously to stay in your camp.
Yeah, that's what a lot of, you know, I didn't realize how unique this was. So when things went south, they said, Mike, you've got a lot of ideas and we think you're a great candidate. We want to keep working with you. And so I even tried to pay them after that. They wouldn't take payment for it. They worked pro bono. I didn't realize how unique that was at the time. I certainly appreciated it. But as I would go around events in the general election and supporting the party and going, and I even drove the bus for some PACs, you know, as one reporter said, he's like, how's it feel from going from a candidate to a bus driver? I'm like, you know what? This is the role God had for me at this moment. And I didn't think it was that, you know, I didn't think it was like a cut down. He thought it was funnier, I guess, than I did. But I got to hear from a lot of other people. They're like, well, what do you mean? You know, of course your team's still on board. You know, you're writing them checks. So I got to realize how unique that was.
I remember the last time we talked, we were in Livingston County, and there were several candidates up there for that debate with the Livingston County Republican Party. 9 of the 10 who were in at the time, you were among them. And one of the questions that I asked you at near the end had to do with getting rid of the Department of Education. And you had a line there about questioning whether the party was going so far right in trying to eliminate that office that they were actually going left. What kind of reaction did you get from that?
Well, you know, at the time I was one of the few with, you know, we were the first one to come out with a tour bus, and I literally thought that we were going to get chased out of town with pitchforks and a torch. And we got done with the forum, and my main consultant, he's like, you know, you had some good answers, but could you please stop punching the base in the mouth? I'm like, what? And he goes, you know, that wasn't a bad answer because I don't think we can constitutionally even get rid of the Department of Education in Michigan, but it go, you know, you're just, no one's hearing it. And, you know, as a parent, you know, one of those things that always is a frustrating experience, I guess, and gratifying is when you give your kid advice and then 3 years later, you realize you got to take that advice. So my oldest was in elementary school at the time, and I forget what he was doing, but he did something. And we're sitting at the dinner table, my wife and I, and we're sitting with him. All the other kids have gone to bed because we're trying to sort this through. And all of a sudden it pops in my head. I looked at him and I go, what difference does it make if you're right, if no one listens to you? And it was kind of a profound thing. We've used that in a lot of our businesses now and teaching with kids. And all of a sudden, as I was trying to argue with my consultant that I said it the right way, I hear my own words resonate going, what difference does it make if you're right, if no one listens to you? So a week later, we're in Gaylord for another similar forum or whatever it was. And all we did was this. They asked the same question. I go, you know, we're not the party of canceling things. That's our neighbors on the left. What we do is we find problems and we fix them. And that gave me a standing ovation.
So you are learning some things as you're going through this process.
Well, and I think we have to be humble in that way and realize that you may have a good idea, but again, if you got a great idea but no one listens to you, who cares? So you have to learn how to communicate, how to be able to talk to people. And part of that communicating is being available on different social media platforms. So there's a lot that goes into that.
I wanted to also bring you on because you put out a pitch last week concerning this controversy regarding Bud Light and Anheuser-Busch using a transgender media influencer as part of their Super Bowl ad campaign and the pushback and blowback they got from that. As you have been watching that whole episode break down, what has been striking to you?
Well, one that's gotten very little press is the fact that when you see some of the interviews from their marketing department and that third-party company, one of the things they talked about is they needed to bring in younger customers, so younger drinkers. And the takeaway of the transgender issue, the influencer they used, that person's base, if you will, is predominantly 14 to 17-year-olds. So that, to me, was somewhat concerning. Whether that was an oversight or not, I don't know. But this to me isn't, this is a great example. And we've heard a lot of people talk about, well, they forgot who their customer was. Because their customer, here's what they wanted. It was really two things. I'll oversimplify it, but my wife always says that my brain tends to oversimplify things down to their most annoying degree, which I think is terms of endearment. Some people tell me it might not be, but it feels, you know, it's Mother's Day. So I think that's loving. But here's what Bud Light and Anheuser-Busch, here's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to produce an attractive product via taste and quality and an attractive product via price. That's thing number one, right? Attractive product. Mm-hmm. Thing number two is optimize value for stakeholders. Stakeholders are shareholders. Stakeholders can be the community. Stakeholders can be employees. And they really failed at both of those. That marketing campaign did not make a more attractive product. It did not via taste or price. And when you look at the blowback, and it did not appeal to their base consumer. And then you look at the blowback and what it do. It jeopardized or at least made the jobs of many people who work there less secure. Look at the hundreds of thousands, millions of people who own shares of Anheuser-Busch that they don't even know they own because it's built within a mutual fund or an ETF inside their retirement fund. So when people go, well, they lost $4 billion of value, one of the things that I always remind people of is, you say Anheuser-Busch lost $4 billion of value. They didn't, you did, I did. All of the shareholders were the ones who lost that value.
Well, and I bring this up also because just today, 25 Republican governors put out a statement in regards to as they put it, restore protection of fairness in girls and women's sports, and basically try and set some standards so that biological boys stay in boys' sports in high school. And that comes on the heels of a Department of Education rule that has been put on the table that would establish that policies violate Title IX when they categorically ban transgender students from participating on sports teams consistent with their gender identity just because of who they are. That proposed rule also recognizes that in some instances, particularly in competitive high school and college athletic environments, some schools may adopt policies that just limit transgender student participation. Are Republicans using this population then, continuing to use them as a wedge for the coming elections? And is that a fair thing to do?
I don't think that's what they're doing. I think what they're doing, and it doesn't, maybe going back to our communicating things well, I don't know that it always gets communicating well. This issue isn't a trans issue, though. This is a woman's rights issue. So my middle child, she's 10 years old. You know, when she was born, and our family's big into sports, my wife's family starts at, all the males start at 6'4". One of her brothers is 7 foot tall, plays basketball in Europe. Our first family, I'm 6'2", our first family reunion, they looked at me and one of the ladies goes, how short are you? I'm like, I'm 6'2", you don't start with how short are you? So I was a big baseball player. I played baseball in Europe on a Team USA when I was in high school. So a big athletic family. So, but we knew when Sophia was born that she was going to, in the professional world, she's going to compete with males. She's going to be, to some degree, if things are the way they are today, at somewhat of a disadvantage, maybe paid less. There's going to be disadvantages. There's some advantages. But Title IX that was created by Congress almost 50 years ago protected that in sports. And the lessons that we learn in sports, you know, my youngest the other day was like, Dad, winning isn't everything. And I get a little intense maybe. I'm like, well, bud, I agree. But the preparation to do everything that you needed to do so that you could play the very best that you were capable of playing, that's what I'm trying to focus on. And that seemed to hopefully make sense and not give me too much judgment here. But I think that's really what we're trying to communicate right now, that this is a message about protecting women's rights. And that should be something we all agree on, because we agreed on that 50 years ago. That's why we created Title IX. And Title IX also is, and I always thought, I met with the athletic director at Eastern Michigan last year. That's where I played baseball and got my bachelor's degree. And we were talking about, I always thought Title IX was equal number of sports. So for every male sport, there's got to be a female sport. In fact, it's actually equal number, approximately equal number of scholarships. And again, I'm oversimplifying it this way. So this, what they're trying to do by protecting is protecting that right to compete, right to have scholarships, right for advancement. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So, yeah,
but one could argue though that these biologically born males are actually females. They are females in the wrong body. So where do their rights fit into this?
Well, I mean, we can make lots of arguments about a lot of different things. I think the argument that's trying to be made is saying that they're being excluded. And I think that's the only valid, you know, the argument that I've heard. Well, they're not being excluded, because when they were born, they had access to all of these sports that are a male sport, because males have different hormones. Males have different bodies. Look at the differences between basketball. So when I first moved to this side of the state for about 3 years, we were asked, a employee and I, we were asked to do the announcing for Cornerstone's women's basketball team. And we had a great time. It was a fun thing. And it was, again, we're a very sports-oriented kind of family. And then one day they said, well, will you do the males? And it was completely, I mean, we already know it's, the game's different, but when you get into it and you're announcing games and you're doing play-by-play and color commentary and you kind of get used to a style of play, I'll tell you, then all of a sudden announcing a males game, it was a different, it's the same game, but played differently. Because again, men are going to have different biological advantages. So ignoring that is not a valid argument. And so I think the real message that's trying to be communicated here is that this is a women's rights issue, and let's protect that.
We've only got a couple minutes left. Is there anything else that you think has been striking as you've been getting the ball rolling on this congressional campaign?
Well, I mean, one last thought on the Budweiser thing. I think it's a matter of, as I said earlier, kind of forgetting who their customer is. And what I see is the U.S. has kind of done that on the world scale too. So we hear a lot of talk about losing the U.S. dollars being the world reserve. It's gone from, in a short period of time, it's gone from about 70% to 40%. And I get clients asking me all the time, like, Mike, I think China, you know, I saw this report, China and Russia are colluding and they're trying to get Saudi Arabia to go off the dollar to price oil. And again, I simplify and I go, well, think about it. The U.S. is going around the world saying oil is really bad. Fossil fuels are evil. They're destroying the environment and they're going to kill everybody. Of course, Saudi Arabia wants to go off the U.S. dollar. We're calling their baby ugly. We're forgetting who our customer is, because the world used the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency because we were stable. We had one of the most powerful, and we still do arguably, powerful militaries, one of the most powerful and stable economies. And that's why we went on the U.S. dollar. And this is very important because we pay our debts in the U.S. dollar. But what's happening is, and I think these world economies and governments, they put up with the fact that we want a democracy. They were okay with it. Maybe they didn't congratulate it, but we really just said, hey, if you're a democratic nation, we'll stand with you. We'll help fight that fight for you. But now we're going across the world, and like India as an example, where people are saying, well, why is India talking about stop using the U.S. dollar? Well, India's in their industrial revolution. When America was in our industrial revolution, we used the cheapest form of energy we could. And now we're looking at India and going, well, I get it that you're in that same stage of growth that we were 100 years ago, but you can't use this stuff. And India's looking at us going, wait a minute, you made all the money, you've got all this wealth, and you did it this way, and now you're telling us that we can't do it that way? It's hypocritical, and we're forgetting who our customers. So we've got to stop kind of pushing these external kind of ideologies around the world, because if we don't, we will go, you know, countries will continue to look for alternatives to the US dollar, which then makes our debt harder to pay. And it makes the debt and the deficits we have far more damaging and dangerous.
Being a financial practice owner, you would know a little bit about this subject, and appreciate you sharing that that perspective with us. Michael Markey, congressional candidate in the 3rd Congressional District, business owner. Appreciate you joining us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Mike Markey for joining us for the podcast. David Trott, former congressman and starting things off, House Appropriations Committee Chair Angela Whitworth. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. For the boss, John Rurink, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.